This novitiate, this terrible school of abnegation, is undertaken voluntarily, in the hope of self-conquest, of self-mastery, in order, after a life of obedience, to attain perfect freedom, that is, from self, to escape the lot of those who have lived their whole life without finding their true selves in themselves. This institution of elders is not founded on theory, but was established in the East from the practice of 1,000 years. The obligations due to an elder are not the ordinary obedience which has always existed in our Russian monasteries. The obligation involves confession to the elder by all who have submitted themselves to him, and to the indissoluble bond between him and them. The story is told, for instance, that in the early days of Christianity one such novice, failing to fulfill some command laid upon him by his elder, left his monastery in Syria and went to Egypt. There, after great exploits, he was found worthy at last to suffer torture and a martyr's death for the faith. When the church, regarding him as a saint, was burying him, suddenly, at the deacon's exhortation, "Depart all ye unbaptized," the coffin containing the martyr's body left its place and was cast forth from the church, and this took place 3 times. And only at last they learned that this holy man had broken his vow of obedience and left his elder, and, therefore, could not be forgiven without the elder's absolution in spite of his great deeds. Only after this could the funeral take place. This, of course, is only an old legend. But here is a recent instance. A monk was suddenly commanded by his elder to quit Athos, which he loved as a sacred place and a haven of refuge, and to go first to Jerusalem to do homage to the holy places and then to go to the north to Siberia. "There is the place for thee and not here." The monk, overwhelmed with sorrow, went to the ecumenical patriarch at Constantinople and besought him to release him from his obedience. But the patriarch replied that not only was he unable to release him, but there was not and could not be on earth a power which could release him except the elder who had himself laid that duty upon him. In this way the elders are endowed in certain cases with unbounded and inexplicable authority. That is why in many of our monasteries the institution was at first resisted almost to persecution. Meantime the elders immediately began to be highly esteemed among the people. Masses of the ignorant people as well as of distinction flocked, for instance, to the elders of our monastery to confess their doubts, their sins, and their sufferings, and ask for counsel and admonition. Seeing this, the opponents of the elders declared that the sacrament of confession was being arbitrarily and frivolously degraded, though the continual opening of the heart to the elder by the monk or the layman had nothing of the character of the sacrament. In the end, however, the institution of elders has been retained and is becoming established in Russian monasteries. It is true, perhaps, that this instrument which had stood the test of 1,000 years for the moral regeneration of a man from slavery to freedom and to moral perfectibility may be a two-edged weapon, and it may lead some not to humility and complete self-control but to the most satanic pride, that is, to bondage and not to freedom. The elder Zosima was 65. He came of a family of landowners, had been in the army in early youth, and served in the Caucasus as an officer. He had, no doubt, impressed Alishaw by some peculiar quality of his soul. Alishaw lived in the cell of the elder, who was very fond of him and let him wait upon him. It must be noted that Alishaw was bound by no obligation and could go where he pleased and be absent for whole days. Though he wore the monastic dress, it was voluntarily, not to be different from others. No doubt he liked to do so. Possibly his youthful imagination was deeply stirred by the power and fame of his elder. It was said that so many people had for years past come to confess their sins to Father Zosima and to entreat him for words of advice and healing, that he had acquired the keenest intuition and could tell from an unknown face what a new comer wanted, and what was the suffering on his conscience. He sometimes astounded and almost alarmed his visitors by his knowledge of their secrets before they'd spoken a word. Alishaw noticed that many, almost all, went into the elder for the first time with apprehension and uneasiness, but came out with bright and happy faces. Alishaw was particularly struck by the fact that Father Zosima was not at all stern. On the contrary, he was always almost gay. The monks used to say that he was more drawn to those who were more sinful, and the greater the sinner the more he loved him. There were, no doubt, up to the end of his life, among the monks some who hated and envied him, but they were few in number and they were silent, though among them were some of great dignity in the monastery. One, for instance, of the older monks distinguished for his strict keeping of fasts and vows of silence. But the majority were on Father Zosima's side and very many of them loved him with all their hearts, warmly and sincerely. Some were almost fanatically devoted to him, and declared, though not quite aloud, that he was a saint, that there could be no doubt of it, and, seeing that his end was near, they anticipated miracles and great glory to the monastery in the immediate future from his relics. Alishaw had unquestioning faith in the miraculous power of the elder, just as he had unquestioning faith in the story of the coffin that flew out of the church. He saw many who came with sick children or relatives and besought the elder to lay hands on them and to pray over them, return shortly after, some the next day, and, falling in tears at the elder's feet, thank him for healing their sick. Whether they had really been healed or were simply better in the natural course of the disease was a question which did not exist for Alishaw, for he fully believed in the spiritual power of his teacher and rejoiced in his fame, in his glory, as though it were his own triumph. His heart throbbed, and he beamed, as it were, all over when the elder came out to the gates of the hermitage into the waiting crowd of pilgrims of the humbler class who had flocked from all parts of Russia on purpose to see the elder and obtain his blessing. They fell down before him, wept, kissed his feet, kissed the earth on which he stood, and wailed, while the women held up their children to him and brought him the sick possessed with devils. The elder spoke to them, read a brief prayer over them, blessed them, and dismissed them. Of late he had become so weak through attacks of illness that he was sometimes unable to leave his cell, and the pilgrims waited for him to come out for several days. Alishaw did not wonder why they loved him so, why they fell down before him and wept with emotion merely at seeing his face. Oh! He understood that for the humble soul of the Russian peasant, worn out by grief and toil, and still more by the everlasting injustice and everlasting sin, his own and the world's, it was the greatest need and comfort to find someone or something holy to fall down before and worship. Among us there is sin, injustice, and temptation, but yet, somewhere on earth there is someone holy and exalted. He is the truth. He knows the truth, so it is not dead upon the earth, so it will come one day to us, too, and rule over all the earth according to the promise. Alishaw knew that this was just how the people felt and even reasoned. He understood it, but that the elder Zosima was this saint and custodian of God's truth, of that he had no more doubt than the weeping peasants and the sick women who held out their children to the elder. The conviction that after his death the elder would bring extraordinary glory to the monastery was even stronger in Alishaw than in anyone there, and, of late, a kind of deep flame of inner ecstasy burnt more and more strongly in his heart. He was not at all troubled at this elder's standing as a solitary example before him. No matter. He is holy. He carries in his heart the secret of renewal for all, that power which will, at last, establish truth on the earth, and all men will be holy and love one another, and there will be no more rich nor poor, no exalted nor humbled, but all will be as the children of God, and the true kingdom of Christ will come. That was the dream in Alishaw's heart. The arrival of his two brothers, whom he had not known till then, seemed to make a great impression on Alishaw. He more quickly made friends with his half-brother Dmitri, though he arrived later, than with his own brother Ivan. He was extremely interested in his brother Ivan, but when the latter had been 2 months in the town, though they had met fairly often, they were still not intimate. Alishaw was naturally silent, and he seemed to be expecting something, ashamed about something, while his brother Ivan, though Alishaw noticed at first that he looked long and curiously at him, seemed soon to have left off thinking of him. Alishaw noticed it with some embarrassment. He ascribed his brother's indifference at first to the disparity of their age and education. But he also wondered whether the absence of curiosity and sympathy in Ivan might be due to some other cause entirely unknown to him. He kept fancying that Ivan was absorbed in something, something inward and important, that he was striving towards some goal, perhaps very hard to attain, and that that was why he had no thought for him. Alishaw wondered, too, whether there was not some contempt on the part of the learned atheist for him, a foolish novice. He knew for certain that his brother was an atheist. He could not take offense at this contempt, if it existed, yet, with an uneasy embarrassment which he did not himself understand, he waited for his brother to come nearer to him. Dmitri used to speak of Ivan with the deepest respect and with a peculiar earnestness. From him Alishaw learnt all the details of the important affair which had of late formed such a close and remarkable bond between the two elder brothers. Dmitri's enthusiastic references to Ivan were the more striking in Alishaw's eyes since Dmitri was, compared with Ivan, almost uneducated, and the two brothers were such a contrast in personality and character that it would be difficult to find two men more unlike. It was at this time that the meeting, or, rather gathering of the members of this inharmonious family took place in the cell of the elder who had such an extraordinary influence on Alishaw. The pretext for this gathering was a false one. It was at this time that the discord between Dmitri and his father seemed at its acutest stage and their relations had become insufferably strained. Fyodor Pavlovich seems to have been the first to suggest, apparently in joke, that they should all meet in Father Zosima's cell, and that, without appealing to his direct intervention, they might more decently come to an understanding under the conciliating influence of the elder's presence. Dmitri, who had never seen the elder, naturally supposed that his father was trying to intimidate him, but, as he secretly blamed himself for his outbursts of temper with his father on several recent occasions, he accepted the challenge. It must be noted that he was not, like Ivan, staying with his father, but living apart at the other end of the town. It happened that Pyotr Alexandrovich Musov, who was staying in the district at the time, caught eagerly at the idea. A liberal of the 40s and 50s, a free thinker and atheist, he may have been led on by boredom or the hope of frivolous diversion. He was suddenly seized with the desire to see the monastery and the holy man. As his lawsuit with the monastery still dragged on, he made it the pretext for seeing the superior, in order to attempt to settle it amicably. A visitor coming with such laudable intentions might be received with more attention and consideration than if he came from simple curiosity. Influences from within the monastery were brought to bear on the elder, who of late had scarcely left his cell, and had been forced by illness to deny even his ordinary visitors. In the end he consented to see them, and the day was fixed. "Who has made me a judge over them?" was all he said, smilingly, to Alishaw. Alishaw was much perturbed when he heard of the proposed visit. Of all the wrangling, quarrelsome party, Dmitri was the only one who could regard the interview seriously. All the others would come from frivolous motives, perhaps insulting to the elder. Alishaw was well aware of that. Ivan and Musov would come from curiosity, perhaps of the coarsest kind, while his father might be contemplating some piece of buffoonery. Though he said nothing, Alishaw thoroughly understood his father. The boy, I repeat, was far from being so simple as everyone thought him. He awaited the day with a heavy heart. No doubt he was always pondering in his mind how the family discord could be ended. But his chief anxiety concerns the elder. He trembled for him, for his glory, and dreaded any affront to him, especially the refined, courteous irony of Musov and the supercilious half utterances of the highly educated Ivan. He even wanted to venture on warning the elder, telling him something about them, but, on second thoughts, said nothing. He only sent word the day before, through a friend, to his brother Dmitri, that he loved him and expected him to keep his promise. Dmitri wondered, for he could not remember what he had promised, but he answered by letter that he would do his utmost not to let himself be provoked by vileness, but that, although he had a deep respect for the elder and for his brother Ivan, He was convinced that the meeting was either a trap for him or an unworthy farce. Nevertheless, I would rather bite out my tongue than be lacking in respect to the sainted man whom you reverence so highly, he wrote in conclusion. Alishaw was not greatly cheered by the letter. Book 2, An Unfortunate Gathering, Chapter 1. They arrive at the monastery. It was a warm, bright day, the end of August. The interview with the elder had been fixed for 11:30, immediately after late Mass. Our visitors did not take part in the service, but arrived just as it was over. First an elegant open carriage, drawn by two valuable horses, drove up with Musoff and a distant relative of his, a young man of 20, called Pyotr Fomich Kalganov. This young man was preparing to enter the university. Musoff, with whom he was staying for the time, was trying to persuade him to go abroad to the University of Zurich or Jena. The young man was still undecided. He was thoughtful and absent-minded. He was nice-looking, strongly built, and rather tall. There was a strange fixity in his gaze at times. Like all very absent-minded people, he would sometimes stare at a person without seeing him. He was silent and rather awkward, but sometimes, when he was alone with anyone, he became talkative and effusive, and would laugh at anything or nothing. But his animation vanished as quickly as it appeared. He was always well and even elaborately dressed. He had already some independent fortune and expectations of much more. He was a friend of Alishaw's. In an ancient, jolting, but roomy, hired carriage, with a pair of old pinkish, grey horses, a long way behind Musoff's carriage, came Fyodor Pavlovich, with his son Ivan. Dmitri was late, though he had been informed of the time the evening before. The visitors left their carriage at the hotel, outside the precincts, and went to the gates of the monastery on foot. Except Fyodor Pavlovich, more of the party had ever seen the monastery, and Musoff had probably not even been to church for 30 years. He looked about him with curiosity, together with assumed ease. But, except the church and the domestic buildings, though these two were ordinary enough, he found nothing of interest in the interior of the monastery. The last of the worshippers were coming out of the church bareheaded and crossing themselves. Among the humbler people were a few of higher rank, two or three ladies and a very old general. They were all staying at the hotel. Our visitors were at once surrounded by beggars, but none of them gave them anything, except young Kalganov, who took a 10-kopeck piece out of his purse, and, nervous and embarrassed, God knows why, hurriedly gave it to an old woman, saying, "Divide it equally." None of his companions made any remark upon it, so that he had no reason to be embarrassed, but, perceiving this, he was even more overcome. It was strange that their arrival did not seem expected, and that they were not received with special honor, though one of them had recently made a donation of 1,000 rubles, while another was a very wealthy and highly cultured landowner, upon whom all in the monastery were in a sense dependent, as a decision of the lawsuit might at any moment put their fishing rights in his hands. Yet no official personage met them. Musoff looked absent-mindedly at the tombstones round the church, and was on the point of saying that the dead buried here must have paid a pretty penny for the right of lying in this holy place, but refrained. His liberal irony was rapidly changing almost into anger. Who the devil is there to ask in this imbecile place? We must find out, for time is passing, he observed suddenly, as though speaking to himself. All at once there came up a bald-headed, elderly man with ingratiating little eyes, wearing a full summer overcoat. Lifting his hat, he introduced himself with a honeyed lisp as Maximov, a landowner of Tula. He at once entered into our visitor's difficulty. Father Zosima lives in the hermitage, apart, 400 paces from the monastery, the other side of the copse. I know it's the other side of the copse, observed Fyodor Pavlovich, but we don't remember the way. It is a long time since we've been here. This way, by this gate, and straight across the copse. The copse. Come with me, won't you? I'll show you. I have to go. I am going myself. This way, this way. They came out of the gate and turned towards the copse. Maximov, a man of 60, ran rather than walked, turning sideways to stare at them all, with an incredible degree of nervous curiosity. His eyes looked starting out of his head. "You see, we have come to the elder upon business of our own," observed Musov severely. "That personage has granted us an audience, so to speak, and so, though we thank you for showing us the way, we cannot ask you to accompany us. I've been there. I've been already, un chevalier parfait," and Maximov snapped his fingers in the air. "Who is a chevalier?" asked Musov. "The elder, the splendid elder, the elder. The honor and glory of the monastery, Zossima. Such an elder." But his incoherent talk was cut short by a very pale, wan-looking monk of medium height wearing a monk's cap, who overtook them. Fyodor Pavlovich and Musov stopped. The monk, with an extremely courteous, profound bow, announced, "The Father Superior invites all of you gentlemen to dine with him after your visit to the hermitage. At 1 o'clock, not later. And you also," he added, addressing Maximov. "That I certainly will, without fail," cried Fyodor Pavlovich, hugely delighted at the invitation. "And, believe me, we've all given our word to behave properly here. And you, Pyotr Alexandrovich, will you go, too?"
"Yes, of course. What have I come for but to study all the customs here? The only obstacle to me is your company."
"Yes, Dmitri Fyodorovich is non-existent as yet. It would be a capital thing if he didn't turn up. Do you suppose I like all this business, and in your company, too? So we will come to dinner. Thank the Father Superior," he said to the monk. "No, it is my duty now to conduct you to the elder," answered the monk. "If so, I'll go straight to the Father Superior."
"To the Father Superior," babbled Maximov.
"The Father Superior is engaged just now." "But as you please," the monk hesitated. "Impertinent old man," Musov observed aloud, while Maximov ran back to the monastery.
"He's like von Sonn," Fyodor Pavlovich said suddenly.
"Is that all you can think of? In what way is he like von Sonn? Have you ever seen von Sonn?"
"I've seen his portrait. It's not the features, but something indefinable. He's a second von Sonn. I can always tell from the physiognomy."
"Ah, I dare say you are a connoisseur in that. But, look here, Fyodor Pavlovich, you said just now that we had given our word to behave properly. Remember it. I advise you to control yourself. But, if you begin to play the fool, I don't intend to be associated with you here. You see what a man he is," he turned to the monk, "I'm afraid to go among decent people with him." A fine smile, not without a certain slyness, came onto the pale, bloodless lips of the monk, but he made no reply, and was evidently silent from a sense of his own dignity. Musov frowned more than ever. "Oh, devil take them all. An outer show elaborated through centuries, and nothing but charlatanism and nonsense underneath," flashed through Musov's mind.
"Here's the hermitage."
"We've arrived," cried Fyodor Pavlovich. "The gates are shut." And he repeatedly made the sign of the cross to the saints painted above and on the sides of the gates. "When you go to Rome, you must do as the Romans do. Here in this hermitage, there are 25 saints being saved. They look at one another, and eat cabbages. And not one woman goes in at this gate. That's what is remarkable. And that really is so. But I did hear that the elder receives ladies," he remarked suddenly to the monk. "Women of the people are here too now, lying in the portico the waiting. But for ladies of higher rank, 2 rooms have been built adjoining the portico, but outside the precincts you can see the windows, and the elder goes out to them by an inner passage when he is well enough. They are always outside the precincts. There is a Harkov lady, Madame Holokov, waiting there now with her sick daughter. Probably he has promised to come out to her, though of late he has been so weak that he has hardly shown himself even to the people. So then there are loopholes, after all,
to creep out of the hermitage to the ladies. Don't suppose, Holy Father, that I mean any harm. But do you know that at Athos not only the visits of women are not allowed, but no creature of the female sex, no hens, nor turkey hens, nor cows. Fyodor Pavlovich, I warn you I shall go back and leave you here. They'll turn you out when I'm gone. But I'm not interfering with you, Pyotr Alexandrovich. Look, he cried suddenly, stepping within the precincts, what a vale of roses they live in. Though there were no roses now, there were numbers of rare and beautiful autumn flowers growing wherever there was space for them, and evidently tended by a skillful hand, there were flower beds round the church, and between the tombs, and the one-storied wooden house where the elder lived was also surrounded with flowers. And was it like this in the time of the last elder, Vasnefi? He didn't care for such elegance. They say he used to jump up and thrash even ladies with a stick, observed Fyodor Pavlovich, as he went up the steps. The elder Vasnefi did sometimes seem rather strange, but a great deal that's told is foolishness. He never thrashed anyone, answered the monk. Now, gentlemen, if you will wait a minute I will announce you. Fyodor Pavlovich, for the last time, your compact. Do you hear? Behave properly or I will pay you out. Musov had time to mutter again. I can't think why you are so agitated, Fyodor Pavlovich observed sarcastically. Are you uneasy about your sins? They say he can tell by one's eyes what one has come about. And what a lot you think of their opinion. You, a Parisian, and so advanced. I'm surprised at you. But Musov had no time to reply to this sarcasm. They were asked to come in. He walked in, somewhat irritated. Now, I know myself, I am annoyed, I shall lose my temper and begin to quarrel, and lower myself and my ideas, he reflected. Chapter 2, The Old Buffoon. They entered the room almost at the same moment that the elder came in from his bedroom. They were already in the cell, awaiting the elder, two monks of the hermitage, one the father librarian, and the other Father Pacey, a very learned man, so they said, in delicate health, though not old. There was also a tall young man, who looked about 22, standing in the corner throughout the interview. He had a broad, fresh face, and clever, observant, narrow brown eyes, and was wearing ordinary dress. He was a divinity student, living under the protection of the monastery. His expression was one of unquestioning, but self-respecting, reverence. Being in a subordinate and dependent position, and so not on an equality with the guests, he did not greet them with a bow. Father Zosima was accompanied by a novice, and by Alishaw. The two monks rose and greeted him with a very deep bow, touching the ground with their fingers, then kissed his hand. Blessing them, the elder replied with as deep a reverence to them, and asked their blessing. The whole ceremony was performed very seriously and with an appearance of feeling, not like an everyday rite. But Musov fancied that it was all done with intentional impressiveness. He stood in front of the other visitors. He had reflected upon it the evening before, from simple politeness, since it was the custom here, to have gone up to receive the elder's blessing, even if he did not kiss his hand. But when he saw all this bowing and kissing on the part of the monks he instantly changed his mind. With dignified gravity he made a rather deep, conventional bow, and moved away to a chair. Fyodor Pavlovich did the same, mimicking Musov like an ape. Ivan bowed with great dignity and courtesy, but he too kept his hands at his sides, while Kalganov was so confused that he did not bow at all. The elder let fall the hand raised to bless them, and bowing to them again, asked them all to sit down. The blood rushed to Alishaw's cheeks. He was ashamed. His forebodings were coming true. Father Zosima sat down on a very old, fashioned mahogany sofa, covered with leather, and made his visitors sit down in a row along the opposite wall on four mahogany chairs, covered with shabby black leather. The monks sat, one at the door and the other at the window. The divinity student, the novice, and Alishaw remained standing. The cell was not very large and had a faded look. It contained nothing but the most necessary furniture, of coarse and poor quality. There were two pots of flowers in the window, and a number of holy pictures in the corner. Before one huge ancient icon of the Virgin a lamp was burning. Near it were two other holy pictures in shining settings, and, next them, carved cherubim, china eggs, a Catholic cross of ivory, with a Mater Dolor Rosa embracing it, and several foreign engravings from the great Italian artists of past centuries.